My name's Leslie, and I'm an alcoholic. I was first introduced to Brad. I went to a candlelight meeting last year sometime, and I heard his laugh. And it's very distinctive. You know what I'm talking about if you've heard it. But I really love what he had to share, and that's why I was very, you know, I always really made sure to listen when he was sharing. But I've gotten very close to him in the past few months, and I love having him in my life. He's just really great AA, really great for me to be around. And he came in really young, and he has quite some time now. And I'm just very grateful to have him in my life. And I've heard some of the things in his story, and I'm just very, not impressed, but it's very, you know, like, well, inspiring. But if he, you know, got through some of the things, then I know I can get through a lot of things too. And with that, I give you Brad.
My name's Brad, and I'm an alcoholic. We'll take this off. Yeah, kind of reminds me of what the cow said to the farmer on a cold winter morning. Thank you for the warm hands. I actually stole that from a speaker who happened to be Anthony Robbins' mentor some years ago when I was in Amway. But I've also heard several people qualify themselves here the last few weeks, so I'll do that myself. My sobriety date is 7/16 of 81. My birth date is 7/18 of 58. For those doing the math, that says I'm 49 years old and have been sober for 26 years by the grace of God, because believe me, there are many times that I didn't do it. My home group is the Friday Night Frights Candlelight Meeting. I'm also the GSR for that. And my speaker is still sharing the promises with all of us, or my sponsor is still sharing the promises with all of us. It's Bill. I've known Bill for many years now. Also very happy to have him as a friend. I'll start out by telling you that I was born in Fort Benning, Georgia. My dad's retired Army. And I moved quite a bit when I was a young man. By the time I was 20, I had moved 50 times. So I had this sense of not belonging anywhere I went. There was no such thing as making friends. I'd move. There was no sense in it. But I can remember some of my first thoughts, some of my first memories was in Okinawa, Japan. I was roughly 4, 5, 6 years old, somewhere in there. And what I can remember is fear, tremendous, outrageous fear. Fear of the typhoon that we had been in, which really, really devastated me. Fear of how my mom got when she threw my dad's luggage out the front door and told him never to come back. At the same time period, fear of just everything. Everything. Well, that seems to be fairly prevalent for most of my life. Then I'm trying to think about how old I was. I was probably 6 or 7 years old when I can remember my first drink. My dad had invited some guys to play pinochle. And they were drinking Falstaff at the time. And I decided to get a sip because he'd give me a sip of beer. I got a sip of beer from him from the kitchen, went out to the dining room or the living room. We didn't have a dining room. And I kind of liked it. I liked it enough that I come back in about 5 minutes later and went to the next guy at the table and got my sip. Well, I continued to do that until my mom, after cleaning up what I had thrown up, threw everybody out of the house and said that would never happen again. And there for a long time, my parents did not drink in the house because of that. But I didn't forget how that felt. I didn't have a worry in the world. Man, I loved it. Well, because I don't really want to tell a huge drunk log. I mean, after all, half of my life has been in this program. I ended up in high school not really doing much, not fitting in. I mean, in the 70s, I was the guy that wore polyester and double knit while the other guys are wearing their ragged out jeans and holy t-shirts. So I never fit in, just anywhere I went. And I was also a very big liar. My dad had a big problem with me because of all the lies that were told. And it ended up getting so bad that when I would tell him the truth, he wouldn't believe me. And I, as a result of that, I can remember the only time period my dad ever got violent with me is I told him the truth about something and he hit me. I had no clue that a man in his 40s had that much strength to knock me 5 or 6 feet backwards. And at that point, I had no place to live because they also threw me out. That's when my drinking career really started, because the only place I had to live was a cardboard box, and that's where I went to live. The friends that I had at that time, which weren't many, one of them invited me to come over to try to, you know, help me through this. You know, nice friend. And he didn't bother to tell his mother that I was coming over to see him. And I was supposed to hop his fence and throw a pebble up on his window to let him know that I was there. And I did just that. And when I was walking around the back of the house to go meet him, to let him say, hey, all of a sudden I felt this cold, round piece of metal right here. And when I heard the hammer come back, I realized that it was a gun. And there's his mother standing there with a gun in the back of my head. Needless to say, I went to the bathroom. It was a very frightening thing for me. But at the same time period, I started drinking really, really, really heavy that night after we got her to stop pointing the gun at me. And that took several hours. She just really did not appreciate what I had done. But the cardboard box I was living in was just across the street. So after all that was done, I went across the street and decided to drink what I had, which wasn't much. But it was enough at that time period because I had no tolerance to really get me blasted. And there for a long time period, that's what I would do, is go to my cardboard box and drink. You know, I've said in meetings several times that there was a time period in my life that when it rained, I had to change apartments. You know, Manna, Whirlpool, Maytag, cardboard doesn't stand up to rain very well. Well, I kind of got tired of that, and since my dad's in the Army, I decided that the way to get out of this is to join the Navy. And, of course, my dad, the only time period he ever begged me to do anything, got on his knees and begged me not to join the Navy because I couldn't handle the authority. And naturally, being the defiant person that I was and the angry person that I was, I told him what he could do with that opinion, and he signed for me to go into the Navy. I can tell you that after 3 years, he was absolutely right. I could not handle the authority. In 7 years, I made E1 three times, E2 three times, and E3 three times. The really sad thing about that, if for those who know anything about it, is my general quarter station was the trigger man for a weapon called the ASROC. And ASROC happens to be what we fire at submarines, because that's what my field was. And, of course, out at sea, you can't drink. So I did all kinds of drugs. Now, can you imagine, this is my general quarter station and I'm on LSD? I did that all the time. Once I got sober and started realizing some of the things like that I had done, it really frightened the hell out of me, because I surely wouldn't have wanted anybody in that position. And the Navy really was good for me in many ways. It showed me just how bad off I really was. But I couldn't really face it much. Unfortunately, the drinking and the drugging got so severe that all my friends were going to rehab centers. And they never got me, and it took me years to realize that the reason they never got me was because I never sobered up. They never seen me but one way, wasted. That's the way that I was. And when they made me mad, I did whatever I wanted to. Make me mad, I leave. They call it AWOL in the Army. In the Navy, they call it UA. In this one particular time, and I mentioned this one because it really had a lot to do with the decline of my drinking, I decided that I wanted to leave and go on vacation. And they decided that they weren't going to let me, so they restricted me to the ship. Well, unfortunately, my dad being in the Army, he was an expert in the UCMJ, which is the law book. I knew too much. I knew they couldn't do it. So I left anyway. And I had a man there to try to get me for desertion. He was really kind of angry with me. And, of course, I knew that if I took my dog tag and took my ID card and kept it with me, that I had proof of an intent to return. Therefore, they could not get me for desertion. And that's what I did. But I was also kind of broke. I didn't have much money. Even though I was a poker player, a drug dealer, and a loan shark, I never made any money. I always did it up in the drugs and alcohol. Well, I had decided that I needed some extra money, so I had this friend of mine that had this connection. And I went ahead and bought some. And needless to say, there for a little while, there was this chase for bread around the state of Georgia because there was these funny $10 bills showing up everywhere. And all of a sudden, one day, I'm sitting in front of a Captain D's and have this guy, these two gentlemen come up to me and says, "Are you Brad?" And I'm looking at these shoes, and I just know by the shoes, my gut's telling me I'm in big trouble. I'm like, yeah. So they flashed me the badges of the Secret Service. So I proceeded to get arrested by the Secret Service for passing counterfeit money. Well, listen, I'm a coward at heart, so when they started questioning me, I told them everything I knew. But then you're not going to go tell everybody that you told everything that you know. But I couldn't live with the fact that the one man that got it for me didn't know. So I pulled him aside when I got back to the ship and I told him what I had done. His response to that was to hang himself. And I had found him as he was hanging. He did not break his neck. He was strangling him. So I picked him up and I held him as high as I could, and I screamed and I yelled for 45 minutes before a man came to help me cut him down. And then about 3 months later, he decided since that didn't work, a 30-06 would do better. And I felt very, very, very guilty for that for a very long time. And I proceeded to really climb into the bottle and into the drugs pretty bad, pretty bad. I can remember that the night before I was supposed to get on the plane to come down to Atlanta to sign the probation papers, I don't know how I got probation, but I got probation. I was invited to go on something called a Boston booze cruise, because we were up in Boston at the time. Well, I had this idea that if I took this and did this and drank this, that I would have this really long, good buzz, and proceeded to do it. And one of the guys that was driving the bus happened to drink tequila sunrises, and I was a tequila drinker. And he decided to buy me a drink, and he had the bartender port so tall that you can't touch it without spilling it. So I drank one. I don't remember the next drink. Not at all. What I do remember is when I woke up the next morning, I was in my rack on the ship, and I honestly did not know if I had sweated that much or if I had urinated, but I was sopping wet. To light a cigarette, somebody else had to light it and put it in my mouth because I had to bite onto it. I could not hold a cigarette. When they gave me a cup of coffee, they had to give it to me with this much in the bottom of it because I spilled everything. I was shaking so bad. And I had to get on a plane to go sign some probation papers. Well, I also remember standing in the Logan Airport getting ready to come down, and I got this real sick, eerie feeling again. I'm looking at these shoes, and it's like, oh my goodness, here we are again, Secret Service. Paranoid, scared, and I'm standing next to a man that I really did not care for. And that's where I really found out that I was running. I was standing next to Teddy Kennedy. Somehow I had ended up in his entourage. I was just sitting on a duffel bag. Well, I proceeded to pick up that duffel bag and run. Because after all, they knew who I was. Well, ended up down here in Atlanta, and I'm sitting in my parents' dining room. And my mom looked at me one day, that particular evening, because she could see that I was still so bad I couldn't hold a cigarette. And she's like, "Well, have a good time last night?" "No, because this is just several nights later. I've got the timing a little off on that." I said, "No, I didn't." She said, "The night before?" I said, "No." And each time her eyes keep getting a little bigger and a little bigger. She says, "Well, the night before that?" "No." "Night before that?" I'm like, "Yeah." And then she proceeded to ask a question that I really didn't expect. She's looking at me and says, "If I ask you what kind of drugs you have done, would you tell me the truth?" And I said, "Yeah." My dad's response was, "You damn liar." And he walked out. Well, Needless to say, she started asking. And needless to say, I started telling the truth. I'd never really seen my mother scared before. But she was deathly afraid. Because you see, when I got to this program, I really did not know if I was an alcoholic. I had no clue. To this day, I can't tell you what my drug of choice was. Because my drug of choice was obliteration. As rapidly as I could get there, and I was good at it. Didn't matter what it was. I did it. Well, I got lucky and got the probation, got all that taken care of, and got back on a plane to get back up to the ship. And somehow got through that. Now, I say somehow because for the most of the time in the Navy, that was about 3 years, I had brief memories. It's almost a total blackout. I mean, at one time period, I did some stuff in Amsterdam. I came to 4.5 months later, 3.5 months later, in Boston, Massachusetts. You know, whole ocean went by. I didn't know anything about it, which was not unusual for me. Well, when I got out of the Navy, I had a problem that I had no skills except for being a sonar operator. I could hunt for submarines, but that was about all I could do other than drink. So I wandered around not knowing what to do and ended up finding a job as an electrician's helper with IBEW, a local union here. Well, in the Navy, it's common for everybody to drink and do whatever they do during the workday. You know, that's a common thing. Well, I didn't realize it wasn't a common thing out here. So here I am. I'm dealing with some very high voltage electricity. I'm running pipe and all this stuff, and I'm higher than a kite. That didn't work out too good. And it didn't take long before I didn't have a job. Well, somewhere in the midst of losing that job and getting an apartment because my parents had kicked me out of their home, I ended up on the stalls of the farmers market in Forest Park. I had gotten bad enough to where if I needed to drink, I would actually go to a man that I knew there who was what they called a junk dealer. And what a junk dealer does is he buys a truckload of rotten vegetables or rotten fruit, and he'd hire somebody like me to clean it to get the good stuff out to sell it. And I don't know how many truckloads worth of rotten onions I got into for $20 to get a drink. Enough that I'm very happy I don't have to do that anymore. And yes, I threw up a lot doing it too, because let's face it, them things stink, nasty. And at that time period, living on the stalls, I really didn't have any place to bathe either. So you can imagine how I smelled. It wasn't anything pretty. My mom also worked about a block and a half, 2 blocks away from the farmer's market. And there were many times that she would drive past me and not even acknowledge my existence. And they had totally disowned me. And with as bad off as I was, I could see why. There was really nothing they could do for me. But somewhere in the midst of that, I met a lady that decided to take me off those stalls. And oh, I'm very, very happy for that. And her and I ended up getting married. Well, during the process of our marriage and living together, she was working at a restaurant as a waitress, and she was talking to some people from this place called Napa. I had no idea what it was. I'd driven by here several times. I wondered what all these people gathering was about, but I figured it was something like the Elks Club or something like this. And I remember one evening, about 2 weeks before she decided to inform me that I was an alcoholic, I had a brother come by. And this brother came by to buy some drugs. I mean, that's what I was doing. And he also had some liquor with him, which is, you know, plenty fine for me. Well, in the process of him paying for the drugs, he decided to write a check. And that wasn't good enough. You don't write drug dealers a check. That just doesn't cut it. And I was rather loud and boisterous and angry about it. And unfortunately, the man did something that was Really not a good thing to do. And you'd think from our childhood he would have known this. But he swung at me. All I know is I can remember everything I did, but I had absolutely no control to stop it. I put him in the hospital pretty bad. My mom told me that the next day she couldn't even recognize who he was. I swung until I physically could not swing anymore. He had a friend that was with him, and I asked him afterwards, "Why didn't you stop me?" He says, "Because I wanted to live." I've never seen a look like that in anybody's face, ever. And I can see it all. I can still see it. But I had absolutely no control. I snapped. Well, I knew he was going to turn me in, so I started filling all the electrical sockets with little baggies of my drugs. And then proceeded to start doing them all, one receptacle at a time, along with all the Jim Beam. And one evening, this wife decided to tell me that I was an alcoholic, because she had been talking to all these people who had been watching me. And that didn't go over too good. We ended up in a very large fight. And there's one thing at the time, I didn't handle very well. I did not handle a woman crying in a fight very well at all. But at least I was smart enough that night that I was going to leave. And she begged me to stay. And I decided to. In one sense, that was a very good decision. In another sense, it was a very poor decision. Because I ended up destroying the place that night. I don't know how many walls I put my fists and my feet into. Destroyed some of the property that I cherished very, very much. And in the process of that, I decided to give her an ultimatum. I knew how to get a woman to stop crying. Either quit crying or I'm going to put the bottle in the TV. That didn't work. Well, I did do what I said I was going to do. I threw the bottle on the TV. Now, needless to say, after all that, I calmed down and stepped back and she left. And I grabbed the bottle. It didn't break. Started pouring me a drink. And now I've got this emergency. I mean, you know, I'm really not in good shape. And the emergency is I've got to find out if I'm an alcoholic. So I do what anybody does in an emergency. I dialed 911. You know, I was not a very insane person. They were very kind to me. They took my telephone number and told me to wait by the phone. They'd have somebody call me. And about, you know, 10, 15 minutes later, United Way called. And I don't know how long I spent sitting there drinking whatever I had. But I kept drinking, kept asking the same question. Am I an alcoholic? I kept getting the same answer. I don't know, but I know where you can find out. And they told me the place to find out was right here, this clubhouse called Emma. Now, at the time, this restaurant in this apartment that I was living in was known as September Days. Today, it's known as Claremont Lodge. I mean, I didn't make a lot of money. The year that I got here, I had 17 W-2s and 3 months of unemployment. It made me mad. I leave. And I can remember I walked in that next morning. I sat right back there in the corner. I wanted to leave, and I walked into a speaker meeting. Sarah was telling her story for Sarah, which I thought was strange. But after, and it was also a birthday meeting. And after the meeting, they kind of surrounded me and didn't let me out of this place. Well, I can remember being in that chair. I can remember the cake that I was handed, but I don't remember much else other than it was Sarah telling her story for Sarah. Well, I saw smiling faces. I saw people that was happy. And I was so far out of it, when they told me to come back, I did. And they told me to keep coming back, so I did. But I really did not know if I was an alcoholic. Had no clue. But I kept coming around here for about 4.5 months, and damn, you know, I got Stan Parks up here that really shared a lot with me. People like Jim Cleveland, Paul Chapelier. I mean, all these guys gave a tremendous amount of their time to me. But I really didn't know if I was an alcoholic. Well, I can remember that on a Sunday night, right there behind the curtains, we were having a meeting, and it was on acceptance. And I got called on, and for some reason, somewhere, I have no clue where, I stood up, said, "I'm damn well not going to accept it," and out the door I was. Now, to this day, I do not know what that was about. What I do know is many of us have seen this little white-haired lady named Marion chase me out the door and couldn't catch me. Because she knew I was drunk even though I hadn't picked up a drink. And the next morning at work, sure enough, somebody threw me a joint. And instead of throwing it back, it went straight to my mouth. And I'm off and running. I was fortunate to have a very special person in my life without knowing it. I was going to an electronics class at the time. And, of course, on the way to the class, I get my Coca-Cola and I fill it half up with 151 so that I've got my drink during class. And this man had been in the program, and he started telling me about his DTs and the snakes and the spiders crawling up the walls. Well, listen, this is a guy that's done 3,000 hits of acid in 3 years. I knew all about those kinds of things, so it was like, no way did I want to experience that. The problem that I was having is I kept doing everything possible not to buy another bottle. And I couldn't not buy another bottle. I didn't know how not to, so I kept doing it. Thank God, 3 days later, when I wanted one so bad I could taste it, I heard something and actually did something that everybody around here told me to do. I called my sponsor, and he asked me, he says, "Well, can you stay sober until a meeting tonight?" I'm scared. I don't know. I really honestly did not know if I could make that. I mean, we're talking 10 hours away. He's like, "Well, okay, can you make it an hour?" "Oh, I don't know if I can make it an hour. I have no clue. I want one now, right now." He got me down to, could I stay sober for a minute? And I'm like, yeah, I could do that. I got my watch out and I'm watching it. Minute passed, and I asked him the most simple question and I could possibly ask. "Now what?" He told me to do it again. Well, I did it again. I'm none too swift. I asked, "Now what?" I went that whole day going several minutes at a time to get to the meeting. And the meeting that night happened to be the Thursday night men's meeting. And at that time period, that was a very, very tough group. And I walked up to somebody that I had a lot of respect for, and I looked at him and said, "Bob," says, "I slipped." Well, Bob had this tendency to sit up here and he's reading his big book before the meeting. Well, he didn't even flinch. He finished his paragraph, looked at me, slipped my ass, he jumped, and went right back to his big book. And I felt about this tall. Because he was the only second man in there that knew that I had gone back out. Now, what nobody really knew was I spent 4.5 months around here not knowing if I was an alcoholic. I didn't know. I'm 22 years old. Most of the people here were in their 40s. How in the world did I blow? Well, it didn't take me long after I really started getting what this program was about to realize that age had nothing to do with it. And there was some very strong sobriety in here that understood that as well. Well, the next morning I came to the 11 o'clock meeting because I quit that job. I wanted to stay sober. And I looked at another man that I had a lot of respect for. His name was Dal. And I looked at Dal. He always sat over there. And I told Dal, I says, "Dal, I slipped." And Dal looked at me and says, "Slipped? That's between shit and syphilis in the dictionary. You jumped." And I stood there with my mouth dropped. Nobody was going to give me any sympathy at all. Poor me. And that's what I was looking for. But these two men had done something I really needed. They told me the truth. You know, it was a very difficult thing to accept. That's what they did. They told me the truth. See, in those 4.5 months here, I was here just because of the smiles and the happiness I saw. Sure, I had gotten a sponsor, but I didn't do anything. Nothing at all. Then I decided to start talking to a sponsor, and that sponsor was, his name was Jason Thompson at the time. Probably the lowest bottom drunk I've ever heard. Thank God I didn't reach those depths. And one of the reasons why I picked him as a sponsor is I had slept in some of the bushes that he had and underneath some of the railroad bridges that he had. So I kind of had an identification with him. And I told him I had a problem with something called powerlessness. What the hell does that mean? And even after the 3 days, even after all the time that I was around here, I had no clue what powerlessness was. So he directed me to somebody that he thought could really help me out. And there was this man, I really think, he did a whole lot more for me than what he realized, or what he did realize. And which is one of the reasons why I try to spend time today and let certain people that have done a lot for me know that they really meant anything. Because he died before I could tell him. There used to be a frying pan downstairs on a plaque on a wall for a man by the name of Morgan Disbrow. And it was Diz that helped me understand what powerlessness was all about. And then Diz asked me to do something after talking to me that particular day. I told him I would do it, knowing for a fact I wouldn't. Because Brad didn't get on his knees. He just didn't do it. Especially for something called God. No way. Not me. I didn't believe in such a thing. And I had told him I would do that with the third step prayer. And you know, I tried to go to bed and not do it, and I just couldn't live with it. So I got up that evening and did just that. And I had gained a relief that night that I had never, ever thought possible. Never thought possible. It was quite an experience. And I was never able to really share with you what occurred to me that night. But one of the things that did occur is after all of that occurred that night, I decided to do a little bit of writing. Simply because I had all this garbage in me, I just decided to start writing. Now, I'm not a writer. At the time, my educational level was that of an eighth grader. I didn't write. I didn't read. I didn't do any of those things. I drank. I did drugs. I did it well. That's it. Well, I don't know how long it was that I just left that piece of paper aside, but one day I decided to read it. And I saw something written on that piece of paper that I couldn't believe came from me. It couldn't have come from me. No way it could have come from me. It was one simple sentence. Time has no meaning in the vastness of now. I didn't think that way. Where in the world did that come from? Couldn't have been me. That was my first indication that there might be a power greater than me, greater than the alcohol and drugs. Well, I finally got through the first step. Wow. The second step wasn't so difficult for me. I had a lot of insanity that I could see. The difficulty for me was that it presumed that I had some sanity to begin with, and that I could never see. Throughout my life, I couldn't see any sane moments. And all I could see was fear and responsibility. My dad, when he went to Vietnam, looked at me on the tarmac and says, you're the son and you're the man of the house. And I took it literal. That's the only way I knew how to live, is to take things literally. And that's what I did. Took everything literally. Well, after I got through the second step, I ended up with the third step, and that was a real tough one. Because now I believe that there was a power greater than me, but it didn't have to be this thing called God. That scared me. That scared me a lot. But I had reached a point where I wanted to stay sober, because you see, for me at that age, it was life or death. You know, it wasn't in and out of rehabs, etc. No, it was life or death for me. I was a gutter drunk. If I was bad off then, just think what's going to happen to me. And with all the smiles that I saw around here, the happy people that I saw around here, I wanted what they had. I'd never known that. But it meant that I was going to have to find this thing called God. So I started searching. And I searched all kinds of literature. I, at first, come to realize that I used a group and a sponsor, because I had a lot of respect for Jason. But I also had a lot of confusion about everything. I mean, my first sponsor was a New York Tough Love sponsor who appointed himself as my sponsor. He was the type of man that told me that I was to sit right there because that's incurable row, and I need to make sure that I understand that I'm incurable. He told me to take the cotton out of my ears, put it in my mouth. And he informed me that I could talk in a meeting when he deemed it was appropriate for me to talk in a meeting. Well, he didn't stay my sponsor too long, as you can imagine. So I reached out to Jason. But then in the process of this time, I kept hearing somebody that I had a lot of respect for. And he seemed to be somebody that didn't judge other people. And you see, that's one of the things that bothered me. Is, you know, here I am, I'm as young as I am. Because at that time period, I was, to my knowledge, the youngest sober member here. And I listened to a lot of what he had to say, and I liked it. So I asked him one day to be my sponsor. Of course, that's after I asked Jason if it was okay if I had two. And Jason was like, sure, go ahead, have two. And one of the things I can remember this man repeatedly telling me over and over and over again, it took a long time, is that feelings are just feelings. You know, they're not right or wrong or good or bad. They're comfortable or uncomfortable. Well, I was such a judge that I judged every feeling, every thought, every act. If I had a thought that wasn't in any way, shape, or form what I deemed appropriate, I was a bad person. Well, it took a long time of understanding that to realize that, you know, it's not so much that I'm a bad person. I am a lost person and I am a very confused person, but not necessarily a bad person. And, you know, as I started working these steps, things started happening in my life. Things started getting a lot better. Somewhere around the fourth step, and the fourth step was funny. I didn't intentionally do a fourth step. Paul Chapelier asked me one day to start writing down my feelings at the end of the night on index cards, because that way I might be able to learn how to identify my feelings appropriately. And I started doing it, not because I wanted to. I started doing it because here's a man I had a lot of respect for that made this suggestion to me. What I did know is I didn't want what I had. So I started doing it. I don't know how many months later it was, but one night I started writing, and the next thing you know, I've got four pages on God, this thing I didn't believe in. And I decided at that point that maybe there's something to this writing, because after all of this, I had a little bit of serenity that I hadn't had before. Now, I don't know about you, my higher power tends to do things that I really need at the times I really need it. And at that point when I was writing all that, I felt kind of worthless and kind of hopeless. And wouldn't you know, the lady, because I was living in a sober environment at the time, the lady that knocks on my door, which is one of the few ladies that lived there, her name was Hope. So I ended up spending hours with a lady named Hope, and I was feeling hopeless. I really needed that. I needed it a lot. Well, that writing turned into a four-step. And it was as thorough of a four-step as I knew how to do at the time. And it was a pretty thorough four-step. But to do a fifth step, I ain't telling anybody this stuff. No way. But you know, there was one person that I did know that I could tell it to, because I never heard him break anybody's anonymity. And he was my sponsor, so I did just that. So I went through that. The ninth step really wasn't that bad for me. Simply because I was in blackouts so much, I had no clue who it was I harmed. So my list was fairly short. I know, it's the truth, though. It was very short because of it. Well, in the process of all this, I'm working at a gas station right down here on Buford Highway. And I'm sitting there one night, and I decide, you know, if I don't make another change in my life, I'm going to sit here pumping gas till I die. And that's not good enough for me. I watch people excel in the program and do better in their lives. And I wanted to do that. At that time period, what I was doing was I was coming to meetings, working the construction job that I had, or a little cabinet making job that I had, for a man who has given many people in this program jobs. They don't make any. And I decided I was going to go to school. Now, I have no idea what I'm going to go to school for, but I got to get out of this gas station. It's killing me. I'm coming to meetings. I'm going to dances. I'm DJing dances here. I'm doing all these types of things, but I'm not really getting anywhere. Now, I had one person that was willing to put me through architectural school. And I had another person that was willing to put me through interior design school. And these people were very interested in helping me do that. They're sober members of the program. But I also have to work for them after I graduate. And that's part of the deal, is they get something out of it too. And I'm all confused, so I decided to take a data entry course just to, can I go to school again? I mean, I've got very poor educational skills. And at the end of this course, the lady pulls me, that was teaching the course, pulled me back and looked at me and says, you know, says, I have never seen a natural for data processing in my life. And that's, you're a natural for it. So that's what I decided to do. She's the one person that had nothing to gain. So I trusted her. Now, mind you, I've got this inferiority complex that's like this. But I have a friend of mine that was here. His name was, what was his name? Well, I don't know. His name was, Jim Anthony. That's what his name was. He happened to be a recruiter for a very good computer school named DeVry and got me to go there to take some tests and start on a career. Now, mind you, I waited to the very, very, very last day because I knew that there's no way in the world this alcoholic was going to make it through a logics test. No way. The only logic that I understood is to drink and to get on my knees at night and to come to a meeting. Outside of that, I had no clue. Well, I did just that, and I didn't get into the bride. Thank God. But I also knew that here I am, I'm working 40 hours a week, I'm drawing the GI Bill, I'm going to I think I was taking 18 to 21 credit hours a trimester, which means I have no spare time. Because I'm dealing with these kids that are reading something and getting it once, and I'm having to read it five times to get half of what they're getting out of it. I was struggling bad. There was no way at my educational level I belonged there. But I was willing to do whatever it took. Well, what it took was cutting out a bunch of meetings. So I did just that. I cut out a bunch of meetings. But I stayed in contact with a lot of people. A lot of people. My goodness, is that late already? Well, eventually what ended up happening was I graduated school, but from a different school. I ended up getting sick of DeVry. And got so sick that it took 2 weeks for me to recover, and I missed all the final exams, and there was no way you can graduate from that. So I ended up going to a different school and getting a certificate in programming. And the process of that is I ended up working for a company that wanted me to do a contract job. And that contract job was to set up the utility billing system for the city of Norcross. And I did that. They told me it couldn't be done. Well, I wanted a job. Don't tell me it can't be done. I did it. Then once that was done, the city of Norcross decided to hire me as their computer department head and create their computer department. So I did. I found out very quickly that I did not belong in an environment where I have press cameras in my face. That is not someplace I'm comfortable. Especially when I did not know how to deal with politics. I mean, even though I was the drug dealer that I was not street savvy, people. I was not at all street savvy. I got in a lot of trouble with it. Well, to make a long story short and kind of speed it up a little bit, I ended up moving to Texas, had a good job out there, come back. And the reason I came back was my mother had been diagnosed with acute emphysema is what they called it. Now, I had watched my grandmother die of acute emphysema. It was not a pretty sight. And I decided to come back here to be with her. And I stuck around for quite a while. And then I had something happen to me which wasn't very pleasant. I mentioned earlier that I could remember beating my brother, but I had no control over it. And one of the things that I've had to learn in this program is that if you don't deal with things, they come back to haunt you. So one evening after I had a very bad day, because I had another one of these bad days where I lost it, I could remember and could see what I had done. But I had no control to stop it. So when I was woke up that night, I was woke up with five police officers around my bed. A couple of them with guns drawn. And found myself in DeKalb County Jail with over 10 years sober. I was in deep shit. Very deep. That's where I really started finding God. Because for me to call and talk to my sponsor meant that they're going to record me, which means I present evidence against me, and I can't do that. That's not a good thing to do. Then after the first day, because the first day was kind of scary. I watched a guy almost get his jugular cut with a razor blade. I got on my knees and decided I needed to figure out how I can get through this situation and stay sober, because if I don't stay sober, I'm a dead man. I know it. But how in the world do you live with this? You know, my first inclination is to do everything possible to lie to get out of it. That's human nature. But that's not working the problem. So what I ended up having to do was, instead of hurting more people that I had hurt, because I learned by that you hurt more people than a specific person, is I pled guilty and I went to prison for 2.5 years. Sober. And then while I was there, I decided, okay, I got this to deal with. What am I going to do to stay sober here? There's no AA meetings. There's none. I was able to get a hold of a big book. That I got a hold of. And I kept my face in that big book when everybody else wasn't around. Because believe me, when you're dealing with convicted murderers, etc., you got to be a little careful. And I didn't really belong there. The one thing I did try to do, and it was kind of funny, because I went to the warden and I asked him if I could work on the computers. The warden looked at me and says, why? And I said, because I would somehow like to repay society for the debt of me being here. And he looked at me and says, yeah, I've heard that shit before. Well, after they let me do that, it got to the point to where the warden used to come in and sit down and talk to me, because he realized that I was serious. I developed a software system for them that the entire state used, because that was the only way I had to make an amend to society for what I had done. Well, after I got out of that, and believe me, that was difficult, because when I did all that, when I pleaded guilty, I was told I was going to spend about 6 months down. I spent all 2.5 years in prison. Had 4.5 years of probation afterwards with a probation officer that told me that she was going to do everything possible to put me back because I was a danger to society. And I'm sober. How in the world do you live with this? Now, there have been years around here that I've talked about surviving the wreckage of our sobriety. I know a little bit about surviving the wreckage of our sobriety. And I started working this program very hard. I decided to do everything possible to uncover every possible thing with me that I could find. You talk about a thorough four-step. Ooh, did I do a thorough four-step. I also had to go through 4.5 years of intense psychotherapy, group psychotherapy, with some of the sickest people I've ever seen in my life. If I thought I was sick in here, no, these guys were sick. And part of that was being polygraphed every week or every month for a while. Most all of my money went to it. I was broke. Well, I mentioned to my mom, as you can imagine, I lost all of my family except for my mother. You know, here it is. I went from the black sheep of the family to the golden boy, back to less than the black sheep of the family. And I proceeded to do everything I could to live this program to make sure that that behavior didn't happen again. I was actually very surprised that it did happen again when it happened. Well, in the long run, what had happened there and all the work that I had done is my mom and I got close enough to where I learned her deepest, darkest secrets. In the process of her acute emphysema, she ended up having a pacemaker put in, and She talks to me over the phone one day and informs me that the battery in her pacemaker had died. And I'm like, okay, well, just going to go get another one? She says, no, I'm tired. I'm not going to get another one. I'm just going to let it go. Which basically meant that she told me that she was going to die. And I was the only person that she told. She couldn't even tell my father that information. And needless to say, that's what she did. She died. We pulled her out of hospice about 3 years ago, and the doctors gave her a week to 2 weeks to live, and she made it 50 weeks. It was one of the most horrible things I've ever seen. But the son that she had disowned is the one person that she told that secret to, because she knew I wouldn't judge her over it. I wouldn't try to change her mind, that I would love her decision, love her for it. And I was able to hold her hand just moments before she died. The only reason I got up from that was to let my dad hold her hand. Now, mind you, the first year out of prison, my dad would look at me and not acknowledge my existence in his own home. It was a very difficult thing to live with. Well, Mom died about 3 years ago. The next year, my grandfather dies. And this is one of the things that really surprises me. The things that happen in this program, in the paradoxes. I had a fiancé that I had been dating for about 3 years, and there were some trust issues between the two of us, so we ended up becoming friends. She asked me in September of last year to give her away to her wedding in Las Vegas, because the one person that had all the rights in the world to step on her and demolish her emotionally didn't do that. Instead, what I did was told her that you made the best decision that you could make at the time, and that it wasn't meant to hurt me, but that's what it did, and that it would be okay. To ask me to give her away at her wedding. What? How in the world does that kind of thing happen? Well, I come back from that to get a phone call one day from my ex-wife. It seemed that my father had died. This was back in October. And I've been dealing with a really nasty event there with the brother that I had beat. Seems he didn't forget it. And some of the difficulties that I've had here in the last few months has been the decision of my dad changing me from the executor to him, knowing what was going to happen. And I've done everything possible that I can do to get close to my dad, knowing that he did the best that he could. You know, he disowned me, that's okay. And he did the best that he could. Here's what you don't know, Leslie. For 17 years, Memorial Day was spent on a parade field. It also happens to be my dad's birthday. So here it is, I'm telling my story. On a day my dad and my family would be on a parade field with him and his dress lives. Thanks, Dad. Thank you.